Hey buds, you are listening to Venus Radio on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal, broadcasting worldwide from CKUT.ca. It's 1:46 p.m., so I've got just under 15 minutes of music for you. Venus airs every Thursday from 12 p.m. to 2 p.m. Eastern Time, and
the following is a previously broadcast program.
My name is Scott Nye, and this is Talking Radical Radio.
The term Two-Spirit is an indigenous word that was introduced in 1990 at the Native American LGBTQ International Gathering in Winnipeg. And it was brought to the gathering as a way to recenter indigenous perspectives, worldviews, and knowledge around gender and sexuality. There were all kinds of terms that were non-indigenous that were used within the academy or within
That's the voice of John Sillaboy. He's today's guest on Talking Radical Radio. This show brings you grassroots voices from across Canada. We give you the chance to hear many different people who are involved in many different struggles, talk about what they're doing, how they're doing it, and why they're doing it, in the belief that such listening can strengthen all of our efforts to change the world. John Sillaboy is Mi'kmaq, and he grew up as part of Eskasoni and Millbrook First Nations in Nova Scotia. When he was 20 years old, he had the opportunity to go to Costa Rica as part of a Canada World Youth Program. It was a tremendous experience. He learned a lot, and he found the culture there resonated in many ways with Mi'kmaq culture. He ended up doing an undergraduate degree in Costa Rica and spent 17 years living and working mostly there. One part of Sillaboy's journey was that he began to come out as gay early during his time in Central America. He moved back to Mi'kma'ki, the territory of the Mi'kmaq people, in 2007 to become a policy analyst for the Atlantic Policy Congress of First Nations Chiefs Secretariat, and at that point he came out to his family and community. It was, he said, quote, a matter of confirmation rather than revelation, end quote, and his family was very supportive. Not long after that, he first encountered the term Two-Spirit, which had origins in an international gathering of gay and lesbian Indigenous people in Winnipeg in 1990. While it is an English language term, and it is pan-Indigenous, meaning it groups together people of many different nations that had many different ways of doing gender and sexuality before colonization, it is nonetheless embraced by many Indigenous people as a way to assert their histories and present-day realities that are quite distinct from LGBTQ settlers, while using it as an entry point to the vast diversity within Indigenous experiences. It was a term that Sillaboy actively took up and began using. Then, in 2010, a particular Mi'kmaq community experienced a number of people dying by suicide in a relatively short time, and 4 of the 10 people who died were Two-Spirit. Many Indigenous communities experience tragically high rates of suicide connected to the ongoing traumas of colonization. In this context, Sillaboy and his friend Duma Young decided that they needed to take action with an eye specifically to the ways in which colonization impacts Two-Spirit people in their region. To do so, they began the process of founding an organization that eventually took on the name Wabanaki Two-Spirit Alliance. And Wabanaki is a term that encompasses a number of Indigenous peoples and their territories in northeastern North America. They knew that their initial priority had to be healing and community building. They had to scrounge for funding, but Sillaboy and Young had plenty of connections to networks within Indigenous service, governance, and academic spaces, and they were able to both find resources and establish a broad reach for their work. They organized a powerful initial gathering, and then many more like it over the years. In the decade and more since the organization was founded, their work has also included things like building capacity in communities, research, knowledge sharing, and advocacy. They center culture in their work. They do their best to support Two-Spirit people doing similar work in their own local communities. They've worked a lot with mainstream LGBTQ organizations to build relationships and to steadily push to expand understanding, spaces, and resources for Two-Spirit people in those contexts. Their research work has done things like capturing the needs of Two-Spirit people in order to articulate them to service providers and funders. Their advocacy has included pushing for more formal and ongoing inclusion of Two-Spirit voices in First Nations governance structures. They're developing their own ethics framework to guide outside researchers who might want to do research involving Two-Spirit people in the region. And they're challenging mainstream data-gathering organizations, including Statistics Canada, to do better at recognizing the realities of Two-Spirit people. Sillaboy has been particularly pleased to see over the last 10 years the extensive involvement of elders in the ongoing conversations that have been thinking through Two-Spirit experiences and identity in terms of culture and teachings. He's also encouraged that the Alliance has been part of broader efforts that have led to significant reductions in suicide by Two-Spirit people in the region. And last year, the Alliance got federal funding and was able to hire staff for the first time. I speak with Sillaboy about his own journey, about Two-Spirit identity, and about the Wabanaki Two-Spirit Alliance.
My name is John R. Sillaboy. I am from Eskazoni and Millbrook First Nations. I live in Djibouktouk, what we call Halifax, and I'm the interim executive director of the Wabanaki Two-Spirit Alliance. The Wabanaki Two-Spirit Alliance, or W2SA, is a grassroots organization that helps to build capacity for Two-Spirit folks in areas of health, education, employment, and overall well-being. The idea is that we provide advocacy, knowledge sharing. We also try to do research and promote gatherings for Two-Spirit folks in our region, the Wabanaki region. Wabanaki is an ancestral word, and that encompasses Mi'kma'ki, which is also a term that we use for this area. And that covers the territory of Nova Scotia, New Brunswick, PEI, the Gaspé region, Newfoundland and Labrador, and the state of Maine in the U.S. The family that I come from has been involved in activities that have to do with community well-being, language preservation and promotion. So since I was young, I've been involved in various things. As a youth in Millbrook, for example, I started navigating different things around, you know, activities for adolescents in what we call youth councils at the time. Then later, I went to finish my high school in Quebec and then went on to post-secondary in Quebec. And going into my 20th year at CEGEP, there was an opportunity for me to go on this exchange program called Canada World Youth. And as a 20-year-old coming from a First Nations community with limited resources and a poor family background, this offered me an opportunity to know another part of the world. So I'd gone to Costa Rica. And that program really was an eye-opening experience because then I started to learn more about environmental awareness and social development from an international perspective. And at the same time, learning Spanish. And I really connected to the culture because I looked at the cultural context of Costa Rica as very similar to Mi'kmaq, you know, how they're connected to family, their language, their traditions, and all this. I eventually did ditch my studies in Quebec and started university in Costa Rica. So I started it fresh. And then I just did my undergrad in Costa Rica International Relations, which allowed me to expand even more knowledge in the area of development and social awareness and cultural awareness. And coming back and forth in Canada and back to my community of Millbrook and Eskazoni, making sure that I maintain my language. I speak Mi'kmaq as well. Then I ended up staying in Costa Rica for 17 years almost. But eventually made my way back to Mi'kma'ki, or my ancestral territory here. In 2017, I started working as a policy analyst at Atlantic Policy Congress, First Nations Chief Secretariat. My work started going back to being involved in community development, economic development, health, and education, and my interest in research. I had been out since I was 20 years old, or 21, back in Costa Rica. I came out then, but I hadn't been out to my community here in Mi'kmaq. Hadn't been out to my family yet, but it was just a matter of confirmation rather than revelation. Back in 2007, I made a concerted effort to come out to my family, and my family was very supportive. But then I began to get involved in different activities that have to do with being two-spirit. And that's the first time I've heard that term. And then I wanted to know more. Then I started analyzing and studying literature and reading up about the context and the conceptualization of two-spirit. And that's where my grassroots and research activism started in 2010. And it wasn't by accident. Something happened in one of our communities that triggered that. And it was suicide. We had health issues with some people who were dealing with addictions and some mental health situations, but also they're dealing with their own self-identity. So these folks who were in this one community didn't make it. 4 out of 10 that had experienced suicides that year were two-spirit. So a friend of mine named Duma Young knew I was working in a policy organization with a huge networking ability around the Atlantic region. And he had a lot of networking ability as well. We got together and we said, we have to do something. The impact of those suicides really affected the community wholly, but also it affected the two-spirit community that was just emerging to understand who we are as two-spirits. There have been people using terms like gay, lesbian, bisexual, trans, queer in the indigenous community, but a lot of people weren't using two-spirit. Duma was one of the people who brought it to our region and started rebuilding that sense of identity around the region. So we collaborated on founding the Wabanaki Two-Spirit Alliance because of the need to build all those supports.
Go into a bit more detail about the meaning and significance of two-spirit identity.
The term two-spirit is a pan-Indigenous word that was introduced in 1990 at the Native American LGBTQ International Gathering in Winnipeg. And it was brought to the gathering as a way to recenter Indigenous perspectives, worldviews, and knowledge around gender and sexuality. There were all kinds of terms that were non-Indigenous that were used within the academy or within literature or in the arts even. And it wasn't centered around our Indigenous ways of being and knowing. So when Myra Laramie came and shared this term, it was well accepted by the Indigenous community because it came from the Indigenous community. Although it's an English term, it was a term that bound our sense of collective identity as Indigenous people. Some people looked at it as a honoring of the male-female within the body, but other people expanded and included, you know, the various gendering processes that people go through or the numerous perspectives around genders. It's not simply a male-female gendering process. Indigenous folks in different cultures and languages have had terms that they had for two-spirit. And for us in the Atlantic, we didn't have a word for two-spirit in Mi'kmaq, and we still don't. We're exploring that, but we'll come to that point in a second. The idea was to then understand, okay, so what is two-spirit in Mi'kmaq or Wulustigwiig or let's say the Innu or Passamaquoddy, like any of our nations that are part of our ancestral territory. So two-spirit, we revisited it, and then I had to look at it from a cultural lens. I delved into a study for my master's to look at what it means from a Mi'kmaq or Ulnaway worldview. And I used our cultural lens, such as interconnectedness, our sense of spiritual identity, and our connection to our culture and land and our surroundings. And I started navigating to try to understand how a person who may have been two-spirit 500 years ago would have tried to navigate their own identity before contact, right? Because we didn't have these words. And if there were words around the region, then they may have been eroded or tabooed into non-existence because of colonial impacts or Christianity and or just fallen out of use because language evolves. So that's part of the journey that we're looking at is how to identify two-spirit. And that's part of my academic studies now at McGill with my PhD program.
What was involved in practical terms in founding the Wabanaki Two-Spirit Alliance?
Because we were so impacted, the first thing we had to do was to heal the people who are impacted by the loss of life. And Duma had experience already as a person who attended the gatherings. The first international gathering that was held in the region was at Rexton, New Brunswick in 1995. And Duma played a key role in that with other two-spirit Mi'kmaq and Wulustigwiig folks from the region. And they continue to maintain those friendships and those connections and networking with other two-spirits across the region and nationally and internationally. So Duma said, we're just going to have a gathering. And to do so, we needed funding. So Duma being a professor and also working with various First Nations in the region, and I was working for the APC, and we mustered enough money to bring people together. And then we also gained support by a research program back then, which provided a little bit of funding for us to ask the question if we're interested in doing research around Two Spirit needs. And that's how we started. So we came up with this name, and then we consolidated at the first regional gathering that took place at Liscombe Lodge in Nova Scotia in 2010. We had 50 people come. It was a four-day ceremony where we had workshops, cultural activities. We had a two-spirit powwow. We had a series of other activities that were culturally bound to have people share our space and to make sure that we provided them with supports, with ceremony, smudging, sweating, with dance and music and drumming. All of these were part of the healing journey that we had there. And it was quite powerful. And in one of the sessions, there were 50 people in a sharing circle sharing their experiences as two spirits. They talked about coming out. They talked about some of the challenges that they faced. And the common theme that emerged was that people during their process of coming out had dealt with it alone or dealt with it with family. But then they also had some distresses that had caused perhaps even suicide ideation or attempts to suicide. And that was extremely impactful on the group. And we had to address that right then. But then we also looked at it as a source of hope as well and a sense of resiliency.
What kinds of activities has the Alliance engaged in over the decade plus since then?
We didn't have any money. So we had the resources of knowledge. We had the resources of people. We had the resources of language and culture. With those elements and with our leadership, we started developing proposals. The proposals were mainly at first for gatherings. The immediate need in the first two settings was to build capacity around assist training for suicide prevention for our youth and for our folks who may be impacted by suicide and correlated problems or issues with addictions, for example, with mental health. So we needed to look for those resources first, and we found funding through various initiatives that exist around the region. And with that, we started having the gatherings as workshops and knowledge sharing places. So that was the first part. Then later we started looking at, okay, so who can do drumming workshops? Who can do beating workshops? Who can do workshops around doing regalia? You know, different things that have to do with cultural preservation and resurgence, because there are a lot of traditions that were preventing two spirits from being in their circles and in their ceremonies. So we had to do a lot of workshop and cultural awareness around our First Nation communities, but also outside of the First Nation communities within the mainstream populations in the urban centers, for example. So part of the process that we've been doing for the last 10 years plus is relationship building. We're founded on the model of treaty and treaty education and treaty relations. We follow the peace and friendship ideology where we have to work together to make things happen. For you to be better and for me to be better, we have to collaborate. So that's what we did. We started approaching all these organizations like the Youth Project, like Halifax Pride, like New Glasgow's Pride, places in Newfoundland and Labrador with the friendship centers, with all of the organizations that have to do with Indigenous tribal services. We went out and made probably 20 or 30 presentations per year to different organizations to express who we are and what we can do to collaborate and then partner into developing projects and to build supports for Two-Spirit folks around the region. Just last year, we finally applied for funding through the Federal Ministry for Women and Gender Equality, and we were successful. So that was a game changer. That allowed us to expand and even hire people for the first time.
Let's talk in a little more detail about just a couple of the areas of the Alliance's work. What has your knowledge sharing involved, and why is it an important part of what you do?
In our early days of research, we saw that there was hardly any knowledge around Two-Spirit around our region. So we had to really dig to understand what's going on with Two-Spirit folks. Even at the national level, the amount of data around wellness and well-being and mental health and addictions around Two-Spirit folks is very low. So we're slowly changing that because we're trying to address those issues. So that's one part of the knowledge sharing part, is to let people know, hey, we're here to collaborate on research. We're here to collaborate on sharing who we are to your organizations, because they're allies, they're peer organizations, and they have a deep interest to know more about how they could also provide better services to Two-Spirit folks. So that was part of the knowledge sharing. Then as we got better at the research process, we then started to capture more specific needs. For example, the trans two-spirit community had shared their experiences with the barriers they faced, not only in getting proper assessment and treatment and support, but also follow-up treatment after the fact. We're not a service-providing organization. We provide, let's say, how to navigate the system. We carry people through the process and we help them at the other end. And we also provide supports to the organizations that do receive them because they would need more cultural sensitivity and safety training around Indigenous issues and trans and two-spirit issues. One of the things we did last year was to do a COVID response survey, and we learned quite detailed information around the impacts of COVID. We repeated the survey a year later, and then we managed to submit a manuscript for publication based on that study. But also our report is coming out in a week or so that outlines some of those issues that we found, and some of the data that came from that is influential in helping us determine, okay, what direction we can take this to our peer support networks, but also to our folks within the Indigenous community. And then for ourselves as an alliance in gearing our organization towards priorities that are specific for trans supports. Our peer organizations around the region are very supportive in receiving information from us. They're ready to shift their services to better acquaint to the needs of the two-spirit community. An example of that would be in the 10 years that we've been building our relations with the mainstream 2SLGBTQIA+ community, Halifax Pride has come a long way. When we first started about 10 years ago, Halifax Pride would say, could we get someone from the W2SA come and do a land acknowledgement? Today, now we have a space in Pride while we put up a teepee and we have our own space of doing various workshops. So we've gone from doing land acknowledgements and we were sort of saying, okay, well, let's, you know, push the boundaries every time. And we did. So every year, something new comes up, a new level of relationship building happens. The leadership and the Pride board had always been very open, learning more about two-spirit needs. So that's been an ongoing thing. It doesn't happen overnight. Part of the process is the trust building and the knowledge sharing about our needs, about the spaces we require, and about giving us the adequate space respectfully and meaningfully at these larger mainstream events.
What has the Alliance's advocacy work looked like?
In the last year and a half, we've been collaborating with the national need to look at the missing and murdered Indigenous women and Two-Spirit folks. I represented the W2SA as the interim executive director, but also as an advocate at this table where we looked at specifically how the cost of justice need to be addressed at various levels of government, at various levels of society. There are two-spirit specific costs of justice, and there's 32 of those. So we've been collaborating with all these great leaders across Canada who are elders and knowledge holders and academics to share on a weekly basis with the folks from various intergovernmental levels and intertribal organizations, even with the AFN, for example, Native Women's Association of Canada, and Two Spirits in Motion. The list goes on of all the organizations that were collaborating at this table. The two-spirit advocacy to shift that narrow-sightedness to broaden the scope of the needs that, for example, Canada has to have when it comes to two-spirit, but also our community. So that's why we're collaborating and making sure that the Assembly of First Nations understands that we have to have two-spirits at all the levels of advocacy in the organization. There's a council for youth, there's an elders council, and a women's council. We should have a two-spirit council at the AFN. So we're advocating through our regional chief here, who's very supportive. We're hoping that that can be something that will bring a positive outcome by having a two-spirit council there. But then that'll have to trickle back down to our region. And we have to look at how our two-spirit organization can be recognized as the advocacy organization of the region. We're not asking, we're letting them know that we're doing that. So that's our approach through self-determination as two-spirit folks here. And the other thing that we're trying to get at through advocacy and research is to make sure that people know what our needs are. So we need to improve data management and data capturing tools that understand that two-spirit is an identity and that identity is Indigenous. So we have to make sure that we advocate for those changes. The Wabanaki Two-Spirit Alliance recently is developing an ethics process So we're going to have our own ethics approval process so that any of the research that comes our way, we can collaborate. And we would collaborate with Mi'kmaq Ethics Watch and other intertribal organizations around the region so that they understand what our perspectives are that are gendered and also based on sexuality and sexual health and mental health and everything else that has to do with our well-being. And we have to make sure that our governments here, provincially, federally, and also First Nations leadership, understand that we need to capture these tools at all levels so that we would have clearer data for our needs.
What would you say has been the biggest or most significant change over the course of the decade and more of work by the Alliance and by your many allies and collaborators?
There's two things I'd like to talk about. One is that our elders are supportive of our process. Elders that have been impacted by Indian residential schools and Indian day schools have not had the chance to learn about the concept of Two-Spirit or anything related or what may have been used as a term before Two-Spirit. But people knew people were in our communities who were Two-Spirit. They may have not known that that was the term, but they knew in their families that people were gay, lesbian, bi, trans, or queer in their communities. They've seen them in their families. They knew who they were, their grandchildren, their uncles and aunts. They protected them. They loved them. They nurtured them. But they couldn't provide any cultural awareness or cultural sharing or teachings with them because they didn't exist. So elders in the last 10 years that we've been working with them have been saying, okay, so if those ceremonies don't exist, if those teachings don't exist, how can we reproduce them then? They're the ones that are saying, reproduce these teachings, look for them, find them, and share them back to our youth. The other big thing that I'll share with our process is that in the 10 years that we have been working and making people aware that there are services out there, there is someone to talk to when you're in distress. The number of suicides that we've heard through oral tradition around the region has dramatically dropped. So that's an important consideration. And the fact that more people are coming out younger indicates that people are feeling safer in their community. I'll share about Eskazoni First Nation, for example, that had the crisis back in 2008 and 9 about, you know, the suicide, now has a Two-Spirit organization called Get Me DLC in Eskazoni. It's their own organization. They're the ones that founded it. They had a pride activity in their community. They have, you know, a Two-Spirit powwow. They do all kinds of things that are wonderful for people to be seen, felt, and acknowledged in our community. So those are huge things. Pictou Landing, just a month ago, had their first pride march in the community. We had seen that also in Burnt Church in New Brunswick. So these are all little things that are happening with huge impacts for our youth to see.
You have been listening to my interview with John R. Sillaboy of the Wabanaki Two-Spirit Alliance. To learn more about the organization, go to w2sa.ca. That's w2sa.ca. To find out more about Talking Radical Radio, the guests, the theme music, and the ways that you can listen, go to talkingradical.ca and click on the link for the radio show. On the site, you can sign up for email updates or follow us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, SoundCloud, and other platforms. I'm Scott Nye, a writer and media producer based in Hamilton, Ontario, and the author of two books of Canadian history told through the stories of activists published by Fernwood Publishing. Thank you very much for listening, and I hope you tune in again next week.
McGill University's 4th annual Queer History Month is taking place this October. Join in later in the month for more exciting programming, including a chat with an elder session from 5 to 6:30 p.m. on Tuesday, October 19th, a zine-making workshop on Thursday, October 21st from noon to 2 p.m., a trans and non-binary in academia panel discussion on Wednesday, October 27th from 6 to 8 p.m., and finally a queer open mic night with performances by Opera Queens on Thursday, October 28th, also from 6 to 8 p.m. Queer History Month will be opened and closed by Elder Gawenodas Sidalio Fazio. Visit the Equity at McGill webpages, www.mcgill.ca/equity, for a complete list of Queer History Month events organized by McGill's Office of the Provost and Vice Principal Academic and their partners. The goal of McGill's Queer History Month is to raise awareness, advance education, and increase visibility of 2S LGBTQIA communities by recognizing their histories and contributions, building bridges, and bringing together McGill students, staff, faculty, and alumni, and Montreal community members.
My name is Scott Nye, and this is Talking Radical Radio.
Hello and welcome to Talking Radical Radio, where we bring you grassroots voices from across Canada. We give you the chance to hear many different people who are facing many different struggles talk about what they're doing, how they're doing it, and why they're doing it, in the belief that such listening is a crucial step in strengthening all of our efforts to change the world. On this week's show, I'll be speaking with Pierre Cloutier de Repentigny and Ty Jacob. Usually, the phrase access to justice gets used as a way to talk about access to the legal system. When today's guests use that term, certainly their meaning encompasses access to the legal system, but they take the word justice very seriously in that phrase, and they mean it much more broadly and aspirationally. For them, access to justice is about moving towards justice in a substantive sense, about redistribution, about dismantling unjust hierarchies, about replacing oppressive institutions with new ways of relating with one another, about building a world that allows all of us to thrive. Pierre Cloutier de Repentigny is a lawyer, though he no longer practices. He's just about done a PhD in law at the University of Ottawa and will soon be starting as an assistant professor of law and legal studies at Carleton University. He's also the co-chair of the board of an organization called Justice Trans, an organization dedicated to ensuring access to justice for trans, non-binary, and two-spirit people in the Canadian context. Ty Jacob is a scholar, a community organizer, and a public educator, as well as the project manager and head of research at Justice Trans. The barriers that trans people face when it comes to access to justice are many and high. In the broader sense, they face many forms of discrimination and exclusion in many different settings, in ways that are heightened at all of the intersections with white supremacy, settler colonialism, sexism, ableism, capitalism, and all the rest. In narrower terms, there are also plenty of barriers to trans people specifically related to the legal system. There are lots of details, but much of it boils down to instances of active mistreatment in and by the system, and to a system that just hasn't been built for trans people. As well, lawyers are expensive, and trans people experience disproportionate poverty. The original vision for Justice Trans by its founder, Ben Vanderpay, a two-spirit Inuk, was as an app that would provide trans people with legal information in an easily accessible way. Today, using their website as a clearinghouse for legal information relevant to the lives of trans people in jurisdictions across Canada remains a core element of the work that Justice Trans does. Another aspect of the organization's work is advocacy related to law and policy reform. So far, this has mostly been in response to things proposed by various governments. For instance, when the Liberal government was adding gender identity to the Federal Human Rights Act in 2017, Justice Trans organized a campaign advocating for passage of the legislation. At the moment, Justice Trans is focused on building capacity to allow them to be more proactive in their work on a number of fronts. On the advocacy side, they want to move from reacting to governments to a greater scope to push for reforms based on trans community needs that are not yet on the mainstream radar. On the information side, part of what they want to do is take their existing resources and develop trainings and workshops. Some of those would be targeted at trans people to give them tools to navigate the legal system, but they also want to develop workshops for non-trans people who work in the legal system in hopes of reducing the kinds of hostility, ignorance, and inappropriate treatment that trans people sometimes face. In order to inform all of this, they're in the early stages of a major new research project being spearheaded by Jacob. Over the summer of 2021, they'll be doing interviews with trans, non-binary, gender non-conforming, and two-spirit people across Canada about their access to justice needs and what barriers they face. Moving forward, they're keenly aware of what Cloutier de Repentigny describes as, quote, a wave of anti-trans sentiment that has trickled down into law and government policy, end quote, in the US and the UK. He continued, quote, "While it hasn't happened here, I think it would be foolish to think that we're completely shielded against this type of thing," end quote. And they'll be keeping a close eye on governments across Canada, just in case. I speak with Cloutier de Repentigny and Jacob about access to justice and about the work of Justice Trans.
My name is Pierre Cloutier de Repentigny. I'm a lawyer, but no longer practicing. At the very end of my PhD in law at the University of Ottawa, and will soon start a position as an assistant professor at Carleton University, the Department of Law and Legal Studies. I am gender non-binary. I use any pronouns. And I've been working with Justice Trans first as regular board member from 2016 until now. And from September 2019, I've been the co-chair. And Justice Trans is basically an NGO that's dedicated to promoting and ensuring access to justice for trans people and non-binary folks and two-spirit people throughout Canada.
I'm Ty Jacob. I use they, them pronouns. I'm the project manager and head of research at Justice Trans. I am a scholar and community organizer, and I'm also a public educator, and I write every so often as well.
Tell me a bit more about your respective individual trajectories with the law and with grassroots politics.
Law was not something I was ever contemplating doing, but did very well in college. And that's often a path that's suggested to those of us who do well but don't know where to go. And when I got my acceptance with a scholarship, it's probably the first time that it was something that was in my wheelhouse, so to speak. And then in law school, I half disliked it a lot. It is a lot of work, and especially at first, I don't think I saw it align with my value, which is a lot more on the social justice, especially in terms of environmental justice. But then it did start happening with meeting people, start to see possibility that were outside the kind of typical corporate law or the usual practice that you can see people working in the legal world. It was also quite clear that I was more on the academic side, so that was something I would continue to do more in terms of research. So I did pursue my master at UBC in environmental law, but at the same time started the practice of law after clerking for the federal court, which gave me a lot of experience at first immigration and refugee law. So that was kind of my first approach to it when I started practicing mostly part-time, and a lot of that was queer and trans refugee. And then also from word of mouth, it started to veer a lot more with just trans specific legal needs that were outside the refugee immigration. So a lot of name change and gender marker change, human rights complaints, dealing with employment and landlord and tenant issue, that kind of stuff. And most of it was pro bono, because most people just did not have the resources or an understanding of the legal system to navigate these very complex and very difficult issues that have significant impact on people's lives. So when I decided to do my PhD, which is in environmental law, so not necessarily directly related to that side of my work, I still wanted to stay involved, but I knew that practicing law was outside of the question because PhD in and of itself is just too demanding to continue to do direct legal work. And that's basically when I approached Justice Trans to start helping.
Me getting into grassroots political activism and advocacy and law starts when I was in undergrad at McMaster in Hamilton, and a bunch of stuff led me to come out as non-binary. And in reading about other people that were non-binary and trans, realizing that my whole life I had been taught that there was this administrative system of gender that was binary and that I had to adhere to. And reading people who had been critical of that system of binary gender made me realize that there was a bunch of systems that I should be critical of. Like, it didn't have to stop at gender. There was systems of white supremacy, even systems of citizenship that exist in Canada, systems of colonialism that I should be critical of. And so it flowered into like a critique of a whole bunch of systems that don't need to look the way that they are, and systems that we can change in order to like live in a world that we actually want to live in. I got really, really involved with a bunch of different trans communities and activists. And then I also did my honors thesis at McMaster on a case where a trans woman was barred from using a washroom at a Hamilton public transit bus station. a complaint was brought to the Human Rights Tribunal. And the outcome of that was that the city of Hamilton had to develop a policy for trans and gender nonconforming persons. So I wrote my thesis on that policy and the ways that it was contributing to gentrification in the city, asking questions of how can we create trans inclusive policies that are for all trans people, not just wealthy trans people that are seen as like a creative elite. From there, I went on to do my master's and I did research with trans and gender nonconforming refugees in Toronto. And outside of my academic work, I've also worked as a trans activist and then also doing a lot of work in Palestinian solidarity as a Jewish activist and also looking into like wealth and resource redistribution. And all of my work in academia and grassroots activism brought me to start considering what could my life look like as a lawyer. I applied to law school and I got into law school, but then I also applied to work with Justice Trans and ultimately chose this job with Justice Trans instead of going to law school in the fall. Ultimately, my reflections made me feel like the best way that I, at this moment, can, as a trans person, work in the trans community to exact trans and queer liberation would be not as a lawyer, but as a researcher and as a community researcher, as someone who's researching with the trans community.
What are the origins of Justice Trans?
The founder of the organization is named Ben Van Dorpe, who is a Tewksbury Inuk. When Ben was in law school, he took a class on access to justice and had to do a project that related to technology to facilitate access to justice, and has had the idea of doing the project on creating an app that would facilitate access to justice by providing legal information for the trans community in Canada. And apparently did, in terms of grade, not so good and had the comment that it was not feasible. But Ben, being who he is, was just more motivated to do it. And then alone decided to push through and actually would never have built an app, never have done any of this type of work, did all the work to create the app, to incorporate Justice Trans, to gather the first two other board members that founded the organization. And then from that point, just plow ahead with a bunch of people who donated their time basically into gathering the information and creating this project.
The idea of access to justice seems pretty central to the organization's work. What does that phrase mean?
That is the billion-dollar question, because it's one of those terms that can have multiple meaning and that can be very broad. A lot of people who work traditionally in access to justice tend to describe it as something that I would qualify more as access to the legal system more than access to justice. I've taken the term justice very seriously in the concept, meaning that you're not just trying to access the system and the laws that exist right now, you're trying to improve access to justice as this kind of aspirational goal of eliminating injustice. So in other words, to have access to the kind of life that you would find desirable and just. So of course, part of this is largely legal. The law is present everywhere, especially as someone who's a legal academic. Like basically everything we do all the time and interact with always has some sort of legal relations hidden somewhere. And of course, the law can also be a very powerful tool of change. So it's still quite a big aspect, but I try also that we do not limit ourselves to what exists right now and to try to imagine ways to advocate for change and to provide information to help people to move towards change that are a little bit more substantive and would be considered outside of traditional access to justice type work, such as economic redistribution, which would not necessarily be something that typically thought of access to justice. To summarize it, access to justice is really moving toward justice. You have a goal and it's trying to build a tool so that people are able to achieve this potentially utopic state and maybe never completely achievable in society, but at least you're doing your best effort to move towards it.
The goal of the way that we think of access to justice at Justice Trans is how do we build the world that we want to live in? There's the obvious side of access to justice, which is like access to the legal system. But then there's the larger piece that Pierre also spoke to, which is working towards this broader sense of social justice. that broader sense of social justice, incorporating economic redistribution, incorporating how do we build relations with each other within our communities so that we are living in a society where we treat each other well and where we can solve problems and where when injustice has been done, we understand what accountability looks like. And part of that also at Justice Trans is understanding justice from an abolitionist framework, where the desire is not to put quote unquote bad people into prison. It's to eliminate this idea that doing harm should be punished, and rather to look at what are the roots of harm in our society and how can we change the ways that we live together so that we can actually root out harm. The root of prisons and the use of prisons has often been to police Black and Brown people and to keep the status quo as it is, so that people that are marginalized don't have access to justice in the end, actually.
What are the key obstacles standing in the way of trans people in particular having access to justice as your organization understands it?
The biggest barriers are the systemic barriers. The system is just not built for trans people. Part of the research we're doing right now is to figure in much more detail the exact issue that prevents access to justice. But from what we understand right now, one of the biggest problems is trust. There's a break of trust between many trans people and state institutions in general, but particularly in this case, legal institutions, just not trusting that the results would be positive or that the problem you're facing would be resolved in any way by the legal system. Then after that, there's also a lack of understanding. So a lot of the access to justice research in general, so that's not just for trans people, is the lack of understanding that some of our problems also have a legal solution or are also legal problems. Some areas are well understood. Obviously, criminal law is very obvious, but also family law. These types of things have in the mind of people already a very big legal component. So if you face a problem in that area, you will seek lawyer or at least seek some sort of legal information to give you the tool to navigate this problem versus like landlord and tenant issues. A lot of people tend to imagine those as just more bilateral relationship between you and your landlord when there's a whole legal system and administrative tribunals that are built to deal with these problems, and that a lot of problems that trans people deal with on a regular basis, thinking that there's nothing else to do but to just suffer those problems, actually have a potential solution. And the third biggest one I would say is the economic inequality that's just created by the general discrimination that trans people face. The poverty level of trans people is much below the general poverty average in Canada, which compounds all sorts of difficulty into accessing information, accessing lawyer, being able to pay, to have the resources and the time and the energy even to deal with legal issues.
And on top of that, those systemic barriers that exist to accessing justice. So the ways that systems of oppression like racism, settler colonialism, trans antagonism, ableism, etc., impact marginalized people's experiences with the justice system, a system that is supposed to be neutral but often isn't. Often over-criminalizes people that are parts of Black and Brown communities, queer and trans communities, disabled communities. So if you're looking at a system that over-criminalizes these populations and then you go to people that are parts of these communities and you're like, what is your access to justice? Often people don't even, like Pierre was saying, trust these systems to resolve their issues and don't even look into how their issues might be a part of this system. There's also just the issue of the system itself. Does the system result in fair outcomes? And then on top of that, we talk about symbolic access to justice, which is where people feel like they're recognized by the system. And so if the system makes people feel like they've been over-criminalized, and on top of that, actually over-criminalizes them, people aren't going to feel like they're recognized by the system or going to be able to achieve fair outcomes out of it.
The specific gender identity of trans people, so basically having a gender identity that's outside of the typical system, normativity of society, makes it that you're already, in a sense, taking a gamble that you'll be treated with dignity by the system, just on that very base level. Like, will your name be recognized? Will they use your pronoun, even if it's not the same as your official legal document? That's already an issue that can create difficulty and creates this sense of mistrust, because if you're there to deal with a sensitive issue and you're not even certain that the lawyer will treat you right, then the judge and then the opposite counsel, then the pressure and the dehumanizing aspect of that becomes very prevalent. And then it's quite understandable to think that after that, when someone sees that happening in the media live, they're a trans person. They're like, oh, why would I want to put myself through this? I'll just try to figure another way.
What is Justice Trans doing to work towards access to justice for trans people in Canada?
We've tried to divide our activities into two or three. One of them is just general advocacy, so trying to inform lawmaker and push decision maker into making decisions that are best favorable for trans people, or at least take into account the perspective and lives of trans people. So, for example, one of the big ones that happened while we existed with Bill C-16.
That was the legislation that added gender identity to the Federal Human Rights Act.
We did a big campaign to try to reach senator. So that's one aspect. And right now we're trying to build the capacity of the organization to, instead of being reactive, to start maybe be proactive. So identify the issue that exists right now that are not necessarily in the public eye or in the viewpoint of the government, like not necessarily important right now, but try to push them to make these issues important so that change may happen proactively. The other aspect is information, education, and research. At first, Justice Trans was kind of an information platform, and that is something that's just continuous because the law evolves constantly, and it also takes a lot of time to keep everything updated, and there's always more to add even that we haven't considered because there's so many aspects of access to justice to include in the legal information. And then we're also trying to move towards something that's a little bit more pedagogically interesting, so workshop, trying different mediums so that people better understand the law and the impact of the law on their lives. And then maybe also having this what we call trans competency training for non-trans actors of the legal system so that they can at least be a lot more cognizant of those issues so that when they have trans clients or trans justice seekers are able to deal with it appropriately. And in the more research side, which is better understanding these issues, which feeds basically into the programming and even into the advocacy, because there's some research that have been done, but there's a lack of research of understanding exactly the situation of trans people and the impact of the legal system on them.
The research arm of Justice Trans is where the majority of my work at the organization goes. So right now we're working on a year-long research project where we'll do consultations with trans and non-binary, gender non-conforming, two-spirit people across Canada about their access to justice needs and what barriers they experience in accessing justice, so that we can have a really robust understanding as an organization of what those needs are, so that we can develop programming and advocacy frameworks that can really address those. And then also, so we have access to this research that can be used by other organizations and policymakers in Canada.
Which we have to thank Women and Gender Equality Canada for funding this project.
What's the focus of the advocacy side of the work right now?
Right now, we've taken a pause on this because out of the current research project we're doing, we're going to build a strategic plan. So that will both deal with programming and advocacy. So with that, we'll have a much better idea. One thing I'll say outright, that there's been a wave both in the UK, in the US, to some extent here, but not as much yet, of anti-trans sentiment that has trickled down into law and government policy. And while it hasn't happened here, I think it would be foolish to think that we're completely shielded against this type of thing. So that's, I think, something that we should keep in mind, and especially with certain governments that don't care, let's say, as much for trans issue as other, may be tempted to make change that on the surface might not look immediately anti-trans, but would have a particularly negative effect on the trans population. And otherwise, I think there's also a big move into trying to figure out what's the best way for consent for minors.
Meaning consent for medical procedures.
That's a question that has come back through the course already quite a couple of times, as if there was a difference in capacity to consent to medical treatment that was different for trans minor than for non-trans minor. So far, it doesn't seem to have been the case, but work can be done there to ensure that it's say that way, that there shouldn't be a distinction between different types of medical procedure based on your gender identity. Your capacity to consent is unrelated to your gender, basically.
What would you say to people who are listening, both trans people and non-trans people, about how they can support the work of your organization and how they can support the broader struggle for access to justice for trans people?
One of the things that we'll be having soon is a membership and outreach program. So people will be able to be directly involved in the organization through the membership system, which for trans people will not cost anything unless they are willing to donate. But the goal is participation. And for non-trans people will cost a donation, which in of itself is helpful, but then they'll be able to be kept appraised of what we're doing, much more than just what our communication team is doing. Right now, one thing that would be very helpful is if you are trans, gender non-conforming, two-spirit, or if you know people who are, for the summer during the consultation, we'll basically need a lot of participants that will be willing to share their experience with access to justice. You don't need to have direct experience with the legal system to have relevant things to say. I think basically anyone who is transgender, non-conforming, or two-spirit would be welcome. And then in the more general sense, I think for people who are not trans, education is very important. There's a lot of resources by queer and trans groups that explain basic issue that relates to gender identity. And just being informed about those things can just already help a lot. Otherwise, it's to do what you can to participate in broader justice movements. Some are very trans-specific, some not, like decolonial movement, Black Lives Matter movement, all of these things. Just participate in civil society and demanding justice and not accepting the status quo as it is.
You can also like us on Facebook or Instagram. And that's the best way to stay updated on what we're doing. Become a member when the membership system is launched. Potentially take part in consultations when we start doing the research collection phase this summer. If you're a legal professional, especially reading articles about trans competent lawyering and just like basic stuff like helping trans people get access to healthcare, that's a legal issue. Referring to trans people by the pronouns that they ask you to refer to them by, like using people's requested names. These are all legal issues. These are all about access to justice, and they're things that you can do in your day-to-day life. I also like what Pierre said about supporting broader justice movements like 1492 Land Back Lane, Black Lives Matter, all these racial and anti-colonial justice issues, because there are trans and two-spirit Indigenous people. There are trans Black people. There are trans people in whatever social justice movement you can think of. And so supporting these broad range of social justice movements are also about supporting trans people's access to justice.
You have been listening to my interview with Pierre Cloutier de Repentigny and Ty Jacob of Justice Trans. To learn more about the organization, go to justicetrans.org. To find out more about Talking Radical Radio, the guests, the theme music, and the ways that you can listen, go to talkingradical.ca and click on the link for the radio show. On the site, you can sign up for email updates or follow us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, SoundCloud, and other platforms. I'm Scott Nye, a writer and media producer based in Hamilton, Ontario, and the author of two books of Canadian history told through the stories of activists published by Fernwood Publishing. Thank you very much for listening, and I hope you tune in again next week.
Other than that, I mean, you know, what's going on? What do you say?
Buenas tardes.
And we'll be back.
Missed your favorite show? Not a problem. Go to www.ckut.ca and follow the link to CKUT's easy-to-use archives. Instructions are on the page. 2 months' worth of archives are stored in mono and half a month's worth in stereo.
Pleasant good afternoon to you, Montreal.
If you're having trouble, please email sys@ckut.ca. That's sys@ckut.ca. Oh,
yeah! I want to be your motivator.
When you tell your girlfriend, get changed, you dress like a tramp. Change your password so I can see your messages. When are you going to change your mind, you stubborn idiot? Change your attitude when you talk to me. Change your friends. you better change your tone of voice. It's not up to her to change. It's up to you. Violence against women stops now. Talk about it. Do something about it. And call SOS Violence Conjugale. A message from the gouvernement du Québec.
This is Lucky D. Real food you want. Come to Mango Bay every day.
Real food.
Mango Bay Restaurant, located in the heart of downtown Montreal, 1236 Mackay Street, Suite 201. For reservations, please call 514-875-7082 or visit mangobay.ca. Real food.
Let's get together and feel.
Money quick, quick. Hustle up quick, quick. Mash your word quick, quick. Now me food quick, quick.